Welcome back to the Diary of a CFO podcast, the podcast where finance leaders share the lessons, challenges, and wins that shape their careers as well as their organizations. I'm your host, Wasia Kamon, and today I'm super delighted to have with me Summer Simmons, aka the Cash Queen. Summer Simmons is the Associate VP of Treasury at Victoria's Secret & Co., where she leads cash management, capital structure strategy, and banking relationship. She is a treasury executive with over 20 years of experience and is passionate about mentoring the next generation of finance leaders. At places like Cardinal Health, GE, or Morgan Stanley, she led treasury strategy, managed billions in cash and funding, and built systems that make finance work better behind the scenes. Welcome to the show, Summer.
Wasia, thank you for having me. I've been fangirling you since I stumbled across your podcast. I think of you as my commute buddy on my in-office days because I listen to you in the car and sometimes I hang out in the parking lot to let you wrap up. Such a pleasure to be here with you now and looking forward to our conversation.
Same here. I love your energy. It just comes across in your posts on LinkedIn. I know we meant to have this conversation for months, so I'm so excited to dive in as well. So let's start with your incredible career journey. What led you to the treasury space?
Sure. You will quickly learn that I have a story for everything. So hopefully you'll indulge me. A long time ago, I made a promise to myself that I will only be a volunteer to my career and never a hostage. I have a degree in accounting. I started my career staring at spreadsheets, chasing deadlines, planning my wedding around month-end close. And oftentimes I didn't even get to take my birthday off, which is a big deal for me. And it still stings a little bit. After almost a decade of doing what I was supposed to do, a hallway conversation totally changed my whole career trajectory. I pivoted into treasury and suddenly I wasn't just reporting the past, I was helping shape the future. After stepping into some introductory roles, I now lead treasury for a luxury intimate apparel retailer. What does that mean? It means that I make sure that the money flows, the risks are covered, and the strategy stays tight while still occasionally wearing lip gloss to a budget meeting. Because, you know, you got to wear your favorite lip gloss, especially when it's from the company I work for. So the real plot twist, I would say, is that none of this was part of the plan. I stopped trying to force my career into this neat little box that I figured out somewhere in my 20s. And I started making room for wild opportunities that didn't come with the job description. Because the best chapters of your story, they don't come with turn-by-turn directions. You just have to follow the detours and you just have to trust that you're still on the road.
Oh, very well said. That you're still on track on the road. So inspiring to hear that. And also, by the time you ended in treasury, I know treasury is not always like a function that's popular in finance, right? So why do you think it's overlooked? Because it has so much impact. Like, what do you think people need to understand about the role of treasury?
I think it's overlooked because most people don't know what treasury is. They don't realize what treasury professionals do. We are somewhere between, or at least the perception, somewhere between accounts payable, accounting, and FP&A. The danger is we can physically make a payment, right? So the first time you make a payment for someone, you just became accounts payable. We do dabble in strategy. So it feels a lot like financial planning and analysis. And we do spend a lot of time with our accountants because as we're thinking through transactions, we need to make sure that the accounting will work. So most folks just really don't understand where we are in the finance organization. They don't necessarily understand how it works. And what they underestimate is that it's such a niche discipline within finance and it's overlooked because no one learns treasury in school. We all went through managerial accounting, cost accounting, government accounting, fund accounting. Mm-hmm. We did all of that, but there wasn't this, how do you manage cash? There wasn't this treasury management idea. So most of my peers, everyone that I've kind of grown up with, we all stumbled into it. Most of us started out in finance, some of us not at all. And it was on the job training. So I think of it almost like the vocational discipline in finance that most people have never heard of. And I'll make a shameless plug. If you're on a finance team, I challenge you on your next day in the office, go and figure out who's in Treasury and ask to spend some time with them, whether it's 30 minutes to shadow or half a day. Your world will be rocked by how cool their job is, all the different things that they see, some things you may not be able to see because they may have signed an NDA regarding it. But it is this gem within the organization that really is the backbone of the company. I don't know, I'm going to date myself and say back in the day, Chevrolet's mantra used to be, it's the heartbeat of America, today's Chevrolet. Treasury is the heartbeat of your business. Like, they are making sure that payroll is funded every week, every other week, how often that is. They're making sure that all of your rent and leases are up to date. They're making decisions around what you're acquiring, what you're divesting. They're making decisions about how much you're going to reinvest in your company, if you think of it from a capital expenditure perspective. And all in doing that, they're still managing physical cash in a bank account. And so there is this very tactical piece where you keep the lights on. And then there is an equally large strategic piece, like what does your capital structure look like? How much debt versus equity do you want your portfolio to be made up of? How do investors respond to that, balancing your capital structure? They make sure you have access to liquidity or cash, whether or not you have banks that are lined up to lend you money, what that all looks like. So it's fascinating, and I get excited when we talk about it. And full transparency, most companies, the people in the finance organization, don't know what Treasury does. So we recently did a Treasury 101, where we basically opened up our 10K and we showed pages that people are very familiar with. And then we told them the story underneath it. What does this mean? How does this translate from an inside the building perspective? When we talk about, you know, our big credit card, the big loan, what is that? How did we get there? And it was incredible how the light bulb came on for our colleagues, right? And we had so many inquiries about, well, what do you guys do in this situation? And when are you going to have your next job opening? And that's my favorite part, right? Yes. Like, when people want to join the Treasury team, I know that we've done something right. And I challenge everyone to go and seek out your Treasury team. They're probably hidden in a really tiny corner somewhere, and there may not be many of them, but I assure you, they will not turn down the opportunity to explain what their day job looks like.
That's amazing. And I love how you said we did something 101 to bring people along. So now I'm curious, how was that transition for you moving from accounting to treasury? Because I'm sure your accounting background will help you, because like you said, treasury sits between accounting, FP and AP. So what was that transition like for you? Were you excited when you saw treasury? Were you like, what is this?
A little bit of both, a little bit of all. I will say, the conversation that I had with the leader that was inviting me into the role was epic. So we're standing literally in the pantry. I'm making tea. He's grabbing a coffee and he says, hey, I just moved up from controllership to treasury. I have a role open. Would you consider it? I was like, I don't know anything about that. And he was like, it's budgeting. He's using all these words that I don't use in my vocabulary, like liquidity and forecasting. And I was like, I don't know what any of that means. I'm happy to read the job. I'm happy to talk about it. And he said, is there anything that would be a deal breaker for you? I said, if I don't like it, can I go back to my old job? Mm-hmm. And he said, to book journal entries? I said, yeah, that's the only condition I have. If I come on board and I don't like it, if we give it 90 days and I'm absolutely miserable because I don't know what liquidity means and I literally have to look it up. And everything that you're describing is in the future and everything that I'm accustomed to is in the past. So I don't have that nest egg to hold on to of, well, what did we do this time last year? What did we do this time last month? Everything that you're describing sounds like it hasn't happened yet. And as an accountant, I don't think in the future, I think in the past. It's all historical, as you well know. And he said, okay, I promise if you absolutely don't like it, you can come back. Maybe the first day of work or so in this new role, he said, I want you to open up. And back then we weren't as app heavy because I'm 110 years old, but he said, open up your bank account website. And I want you to look at your inflows and your outflows. And I want you to add 6 zeros to whatever you see in your bank account. And I want you, when you sit down to do our work, I want you to think about how you would manage the cash if it were yours, but practice in your own account. Just add 6 zeros to everything. And I was like, even the outflows? Like, I'd love to add 6 zeros to the inflows and we could eventually work that through my compensation. He was like, nope, add it all. And it really helped in terms of, as an accountant, you're trained to be a fiduciary, you're trained to be really responsible for the company's money, their assets, their liabilities. But when you manage cash, it makes a big difference because that is physically moving out of a bank account. And so if you send too much, it's a problem. If you send too little, that's a problem as well. And I think the best thing that caught me up to speed in this role and got me excited was I am naturally curious. And so in my day job, I get to comb through bank accounts. And the company I was working for at the time had multiple business units. And you got to figure out things like what Boeing pays for an engine for a plane. That's not just information that you would normally have. You get to see what Walmart and Home Depot pay for appliances. What are they paying for from an exchange of inventory perspective? And I don't know about anybody else, but there's something that feels gratuitous about looking at something that it feels like you shouldn't be looking at, like combing through somebody's garbage. You learn so much about them. I've never done it, but combing through someone's bank statement, you learn a lot about them. And that's how I really started to learn cash management. I got a better feel for forecasting isn't off the top of your head. It's usually based on trend analysis. And if you look at 3 months worth of activity, you can see when people tend to pay you. You obviously know when payments are happening because accounts payable tells you when they're happening. But if you want to get an idea of like the entity that managed our credit card at the time, Mondays are heavy inflows because people spend money over the weekend on their credit cards, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and it settles on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And so just getting that feeling for the inflows and outflows of a bank account will really help you to understand how that business works, when's their slow time, when's their busy time from a cash perspective. And then you start to fill in the pieces. And so I think that that curiosity just kept me fed. And this is a very long way to get there, but I've not looked back at a journal entry since. And every now and then, I'm still friends with this leader. It's been, gosh, 12 years since he hired me. And every now and then he'll text me and say, do you miss journal entries? And I'm like, no.
No.
No shade to anyone who's booking journal entries. They are relevant. They're important. I don't miss it. I really stepped out of the past and into the future. And what was best about it is because I came from accounting and because I understood and remembered having to chase people for things, I always kept them in the loop. Hey, this transaction happened. Here's the support for it. We created a folder for you because when you're ready for it in 3 weeks, we would have forgotten. So here it is, nice and packaged up, everything you need. So just being able to take that old experience with me and know what that felt like to chase. I just want to be a great business partner. And I want to make sure that people know that I am being an advocate for them and their work and an ambassador for why that work is important, as I want others to do it for Treasury. So I think it's a win all around. And everybody should go find their Treasury people and spend time with them.
Oh, I love it. I love it. And I like how you said you're making life easy for accounting because you were there, right? And you are that strong business partner for them. But what would you say are some of the way Treasury is a business partner to other functions like AP, the CFO, FP&A team, and other people across the organization? Because it's everyone spending. What does it look like to be a business partner in Treasury?
Yeah, I love this question because when I meet someone who, for instance, I was getting a chai tea at work the other day. So I stopped by our cafe and the young lady who makes it, like, she knows exactly how I like it. We were talking about being particular before. She knows exactly how I like it. And when I show up, I don't even have to say anything. I just say, I would like the, and she was like, how you always get it? Yes. And so in her making it, she was asking, remind me what team you work on again. And I said, I'm in finance, I'm in treasury. And she was like, I'm sorry, I don't know what that means. And I said, what I said to you earlier, you know, I make sure that payroll hits every other week. I do all these things. And I said, I would argue that there is no one in our four walls that doesn't rely on treasury. It's impossible for a team not to engage with us directly or indirectly. Whether you are negotiating a contract for something that's going to happen in the future, you're going to need that money at some point in time. So Treasury needs that forecast. Whether you are exploring the idea of taking on third-party contractors, they too have to be paid. So procurement is going to work with you on the contracts, and Treasury is going to make sure that AP has the necessary funds to execute. And so when I think about all of our key stakeholders, everyone is a key stakeholder. Now, the way most finance teams are designed, the people who face the business have a finance partner that they engage with, and then we then interface with said finance partner. But I think in any environment, in any business, it's impossible to believe that Treasury is not touching. You're sitting in a chair at a table. Treasury has impacted that in some way, shape, or form. And it really, the direct tie-in will typically be to accounts payable, making sure that that cash is available. So when people say things like, you know, I am going to call you if my paycheck is wrong, don't call me for that. I'm not responsible for the payroll itself. I'm responsible for making sure the money is available to pay you, but I don't get involved in the actual payment file associated with that. So think about it at its most base case. Treasury touches the entire organization, hence the reference to it being the backbone. And I would also encourage people not in finance to challenge other folks. As you're thinking about your role and how you need others to be supportive of you, you've got to think about what's important to them, and you have to tie what you need from them to what's important to them, and you will always be a priority for them. As long as you seem like a gnat that they can chase away, they won't want to help, or they won't respond to your emails. And I found with Treasury, the payroll thing and getting paid every other week, people tend to remember me for that. But the bigger picture is, as you're making decisions about your function, whether it is a plane that's going to be on a runway because the engine is complete and it needs to be put into said plane, if there's a payment associated with that, I need you to call me before the plane's on the runway. Like, I need to know about that so we can be ready for what happens next. And as long as there's something that is intrinsic to you that you care about, where I'm related, you will remember, oh, I need to call Summit and tell her about this thing. So it sounds maybe a little selfish, but we are naturally selfish human beings. And if you want people to think about you in your day job the way that you need them to show up, you have to figure out what's important to them so you become a priority for them and they're calling you versus you chasing them. I tease my friends in internal audit as well as my team, and I'll say our goal is not to be right above internal audit because everybody runs from them. I've yet to work for a company where you see someone from audit coming, I don't need this drink, I'll come by later, you're out of there. I don't want people to see us coming and think, oh my gosh, they're going to ask me about that forecast or they're going to ask me why it's wrong. I want them to hang out and say, oh my gosh, I was just thinking about you. We're having conversations about this transaction. And what are your thoughts? What does timing look like? Does that work? How can we make this seamless? That's where I think you're doing an excellent job when you're a top of mind and people think of you and they want to reach out versus run away.
I love it. Like, that's an amazing definition of business partnering, an amazing definition of success as a business partner. I want to dig a step back and see how would that look like in particular when you say that, for example, you have to appeal to what they need, to what's important to them. So now you are part, an essential part of their work. What does it look like, especially working with functions like procurement or other functions? I'm just curious to see if you have any example you can share about how you discovered what was important to them and how did you actually got to be invited in those conversations early enough? Because you've been in accounting, you know how we learn about things like...
Well after the fact.
Well after the...
I think there are a couple of different examples. And if I'm being honest, most of them started out not on the best foot, right? Something went awry. Some transaction needed to happen at the last minute. Treasury was the last to know, and it was a scramble. In those moments of the scramble, you can do two things. You can give somebody a lecture, like you're their parent, and absolutely lose them. Absolutely lose them after that. Or you can deliver what they need and offer them an education after, and you become more of a hero. It is this idea of, hey, Lucia just called, and we're closing on a lease today, and somebody needs a payment at the last minute that slipped through the crack. Can you do it? Yes, we can absolutely do it. And you go figure out how to do it. And as you're delivering the thing, you say, hey, I'm going to put 30 minutes on your calendar next week so we can just kind of talk through this so we can avoid it in the future because I know you are under the gun and this created a pinch for us. And it is not about me telling you how inconvenient this was and how my tea got cold. It is about what this means for the company. if we don't have an accurate cash forecast, we manage our cash. Most companies manage their cash with, they're trying to optimize cash. And so you don't want to have a bunch sitting in a bank account that's not earning interest, just like you would manage your own cash. So if you tell me about something at the very last minute and I have to pull from somewhere unexpectedly, I've either disrupted the amount of interest that I would have earned on those funds, or worse, I am paying interest because I'm having to borrow it. That then impacts the company's bottom line. And once you start talking to them about how this snafu ultimately might impact their bonus, it feels different, right? It hits different. And no one wants to be blamed, but it's less about the blame and more about stepping through this theory that everyone has that treasury teams are sitting in this room that looks like a vault with all this cash. I have yet to be, other than being at a bank on a vault tour, I have yet to sit in a room with piles of cash. And so just taking that visual away from people and helping them to understand we're either one step away from getting what you need or 2 to 3 steps any cost, really helps them understand the implication and understand, you know, they might end up on an exception report, or they now have knowledge that they didn't have. And I think most people come to work wanting to do a good job. And I think most people want to understand as much of the big picture. But I'll tell you what doesn't work. Speaking to them in your jargon does not work. Don't sit people down and beat them over the head with cash optimization and liquidity and capital structure. Speak to them in language that matters to them. Operating income, margin, interest expense, outflow, inflow, negative cash balance, overdraft. People understand that, right? And so if you make sure that you're speaking their language, you will always have their attention. If you speak to them in a way that you speak to your colleagues, it's not interesting. It just feels like you've created more barrier than you've created relationship. And I think once you have the relationship, you're in. Like, nothing excites me more than when someone says, hey, Summit, can you hop on this call? We're going to brainstorm about this. And we just wanted to invite you early. Yes, I would love that. And if I can't, I'm going to send someone on the team, because you also want to reward good behavior. Like, you want people to bring you in early. And I think that's how you find these key stakeholders. So a great example, to your point around like procurement, partnering with them on perhaps initiatives that they're trying to roll out for small businesses. Let's say we want to do business with smaller companies, and we understand that they may not be able to accommodate our 60-day payment terms. We might create an exception for certified minority businesses that we might pay them within 5 days of service, but you have to work with Treasury to understand what that's going to do to liquidity. You work together to figure out what the terms might need to be for it to be attractive for the other party to be paid earlier, versus if we can get a discount for paying you within 5 days versus you getting the whole invoice at 60 days, what makes more sense for your business? And you work with Treasury and your partner to figure out what's the break even on that. When does it start to cost us? When does it level out to what we would have been paid for interest or what we paid for interest? That becomes partnerships that procurement couldn't solve for on their own. Treasury probably wouldn't be thinking about it. And now you have a supplier that's really grateful because they have this option that wouldn't otherwise exist. And those are small bits, but now that procurement team is thinking about you beyond that. And as they think about bigger initiatives and projects, you've identified yourself as a good partner. And if you say no, sometimes they understand because you've vetted it and you've taken them on the journey. I think that's the other piece. Take people on the journey with you. Don't get a question, especially don't answer immediately, nope, we don't do that here.
I had to grow from that.
Right? You're a CFO. You don't want a reputation for being the CF no. You want a reputation for people knowing, if Wasia said no, I trust her to give me the why behind it so I understand how to frame my ask next time. Or I appreciate that it wasn't a no, maybe it was a not yet. So I think taking people on the journey, you don't need to give them the intricacy of your day job because everybody's busy, but make sure that they walk away more educated and help them get to the yes, if it's a viable option. That has seemed to work for me.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's like the perfect textbook of business partnering for sure. And I'm curious to hear now, because I know you work in a lot of M&A deal. And I was curious, as a treasury expert, what are the red flags or green flags you look for when there is an M&A transaction?
So I love this question. And while most of the M&A that I've been, well, let me get to that. Generally, most people think of M&A as buying businesses or acquiring businesses. And my experience has been more on the other side of the equation. So divestitures and joint ventures or JVs. And those are absolutely part of the M&A landscape. They just don't have, you know, an acronym that accounts for them, so to speak.
Yes.
And they come with their own fair share of complexity, especially from a treasury perspective. So here, the focus is less on valuation and it's more on engineering, clean financial separation, and operational readiness. So said differently, when we're done with this, is this business viable to run on its own or run as a shared fundamental? So in divestitures and JVs, the red and green flags can shift from valuation to viability because you're not just evaluating what a business is worth. You're asking, can it stand on its own? Can it function on day one? And so when I think about green flags, I think about a clear path for cash and liquidity separation, well-documented intercompany relationships with a visible path to how do you unwind that intercompany? Like, who are you lending and borrowing to? And what does it look like to pay them back, right? Treasury-specific documentation, like what does our transition services agreement look like? Does it include banking? Does it include cash management? Does it include forecasting? Does it include us still funding you? And then there's standalone financial modeling that shows the business can operate independently, which is what we're ultimately trying to solve for. That tells me that the business is being thoughtfully carved out and not just legally separated. The red flags, they look a little different. Commingled cash pools or shared bank accounts with no exit plan. So if Wasiya has five companies and all the money just goes into one place and I only want to buy one, how do I know which cash is associated from the one I'm buying versus it's just a really saucy version of everything? Mm-hmm. Unclear ownership for working capital or existing debt obligations. Is everybody borrowing independently or is Wasiya borrowing on behalf of everyone? How would you be able to strip that out? No standalone treasury operations. If you said, oh, we don't have a treasury team, you know, the accountants just kind of take care of it. That would make me a little bit nervous. And then assumptions that the infrastructure will just stay the same post-close. Very rarely does the infrastructure stay the very same way because something has fundamentally changed. So is there room to pivot and is there room to figure that out? Because in all of these deals, you're not just transitioning ownership, you're building a new financial foundation. And Treasury's job is to make sure that that foundation is real, reliable, and again, ready to go on day one.
Wow. Thank you. That was a masterclass. I so love it.
There's so much more where that came from.
Oh, yeah. So that's what I'm curious. Like, is there a significant event or transaction or experience that really shaped you to be the treasury leader you are today?
You know, in the context of M&A, I don't know that there was any one thing that's happened in my career, but something interesting happened and it just happens to align with M&A. And I think it's worth sharing this story with you. So early in my career, I supported the tail end, a pretty major divestiture. I wasn't leading the deal, but I was watching closely and everything seemed to be going smooth, but I was still green. And so I didn't know what I didn't know. Years later, I'm at a round table seated next to the treasury lead from the acquiring company. We'd never met before. I randomly used a term from my GE days, from my GE treasury days, and she immediately recognized the term. It turns out her team had adopted and kept most of the treasury process that we handed over to them. So they even like adapted what was existing to accommodate this new process. So that moment really just stuck with me because I didn't own the deal. I can't take any credit for it, but I clearly inherited excellence. And I've carried a lot of those standards into every role I've had since then. On the flip side of that, I've seen deals that had so many red flags in the beginning, like no clear handoffs, limited treasury involvement, shaky fundamentals, and let's just say they ended how they started. So what this taught me in and out of treasury is trust your intuition and always, always do clean work. Because in any environment, and I'll use mine in treasury, what you do today might come back to you 5 years from now, or you could wind up sitting next to the person who owns it, and you either in that moment, you become really fast friends, or you spend the whole time pretending to check your email during lunch because you need to avoid them. Because they've said something, they're like, this was a mess, this thing was terrible. And so just lead with your best at all times. And if it comes back to you, fantastic. And if it doesn't, know that you've put a good work product out into the world. And I just encourage my team to do that at all times. Let's not throw things over the fence, especially if you're on a project. Be the person that people want to work with on a project. I like to think of it as some people are amazing and they will stay on budget. They will get that work done, but they leave a trail of bodies. And when time comes back around and there's this big project and people want the visibility, oh, Wasia's on that project. Oh, never mind. I'll take my chances. I'll stay where I am because you weren't a great partner to work with. You got the work done, but you might have been unpleasant. You might have been unfriendly. You might have been hangry, but be the person that someone looks forward to working with. And more importantly, they're going to bend over backwards to do a good job for you. So I would say just put a good work product out at all times. If your name's going to be on it, make sure that people have nothing but good things to say about what is associated with your name.
Wow, I love it. I love it. And I'm just curious too now, what is the best career advice you ever received? Like in whether it's in accounting or in your treasury days?
I have so many, but I think the one that sticks out is probably the shortest and the most direct. And it's sometimes you're the hammer, sometimes you're the nail. Know which one you are and act accordingly. When the person said it to me, and this is still today one of my favorite leaders, it taught me leadership isn't about always being in charge. It's about knowing when to push. It's about knowing when to listen, when to pivot. And that level of self-awareness, it's not soft. It's essential. Sometimes you have a new leader and you are the expert. You have some options. You could flex on the leader and basically give them the I should have had this job, not you energy. Or you can share with them what they know, become their ambassador, become their right-hand man, and just get them up to speed and let the rest work itself out. Because you know what you know, you're good at what you do, and that person will appreciate the effort, even when they know that maybe you should have had the job. Just show up and do the right thing. You're absolutely the hammer in that moment, but how you handle it really speaks to who you are as a person and your character.
And what would you say is the best way you can show it to the next generation of leader, to your team? Like, how do you become that leader? Because you will move on at some point. But what is a trail? Hopefully not a trail of bodies you're leaving behind, but of people that became better from your leadership. Like, how do you help your team grow into being the business partner you are and being the treasury experts?
I think leading by example, but being really vulnerable and transparent. And when people are doing great work, tell them, hey, you handled that incredibly. I wouldn't have done anything differently. And be consistent with your feedback. Like, I like to invite people into feedback, good, bad, or indifferent. I'll say, well, see, can I give you some feedback? And you're fully allowed to tell me, no, not today, maybe tomorrow, because sometimes you're just not in a position to receive it. And sometimes the feedback is good, but if you say you're not ready for it today, I'll wait. And tomorrow we can have this conversation. But I think of it like Google reviews. I'm going to leave a Google review, good, bad, or indifferent. I'm not the person who's going to get on there and go crazy because I didn't get my way. I am the person that's going to get on there and share my experience. This was the best food I've ever had, but the service lacked. The hostess that we had was incredible. The server was really great. this thing happened, that thing happened. But when you are consistent, people can receive what you're saying in a way that they want to take it with them. And more importantly, in a way that they want to pay that behavior forward. And I think from all the teams that I've been on, I like to believe that I'm getting to know folks that work with me. I never like to say for folks that work with me. I'm getting to know you as a human. And when we sit down to have a TB, you're always going to hear, how are you otherwise? Always. Like, I don't care what big transaction we have going on and you run down your to-do list and that's great. How are you otherwise? Everything else okay? Is there anything I can do? And I think just being someone that shows up consistently for the people around you is how you build strong leaders. The premise of that is I can give you difficult feedback and you don't take it personal, because when you're killing it, I tell you that too. If you did a presentation and it was not your best, I think we should walk through the content more next time, or let me know how I can better support you. I think it's being accessible and being available and approaching relationships as a coach and not as someone that's just wagging a finger and waiting to gotcha. Like, I think just showing up and being a decent person, like, it doesn't always move you quickly. We'll say that. Sometimes it seems the villains move a lot faster, but when you're in bigger roles and you need to recruit, those are the people that want to work for you. Someone that was on your team 5, 6, 7 years ago, maybe earlier in your career, you post on LinkedIn, you have an open role. They may not be dissatisfied where they are, but they appreciated your leadership style. They felt like they grew working for you and they'll take the leap. Like I always say, you know, I'm in treasury now and I really love it. But for some of my best leaders, they could invite me into something completely different and I would likely take the call because I grew under them. I felt supported. I felt developed and I felt unstoppable. Felt like they gave me the space to learn and grow and to make calculated risks. And I love the version of me that was born out of that, because I started out being an accountant who wanted to be a controller when she grew up. And that goal is kind of gone. I don't want to do that. Now I'm just like open to what's next.
And you're probably enjoying your birthdays. I'm curious, what day of the month is your birthday?
It's in August. And I tried to celebrate the whole month. I'm actually, you know, a few weeks out now and I already have most of it teed up. And that is the biggest win for me, to be able to take my birthday off. And if we ever decided to renew our wedding vows, we wouldn't have to plan them around a month right and then. Close.
Yep.
So those are the small things that are never lost on me. And when I reach out to my friends in accounting and we need to work on a project, I always lead with what weeks work best for you, because I get it. So yes, we love being able to celebrate birthdays. It's like anything else. You don't appreciate it until it's taken away. And I'm a huge birthday ambassador. Like the countdown has already started.
I'm a big birthday. I celebrate my birthday month and I usually have 2 or 3 cakes around the birthday because I like to eat the cake. I like, so I have a nothing bun cake in the morning. I wake up, I have cake. It's my birthday. And then
I'm not judging.
Yeah.
Trust me, you're speaking my language. I am so not judging. Like there are multiple cakes.
Yes.
Like it's a season of cake.
Yes. Yes. I like my cakes. I like having cake for breakfast the next 2-3 days. So I'll get a good size cake because you have to eat cake on your birthday.
It's not your birthday without cake,
yes,
is how I think of it.
Same.
And I am a big fan of, like, I like to recreate experiences and I love nothing but cake. What's your favorite?
Oh, the white chocolate with the raspberry.
Is there a signature with the raspberry?
Yeah.
Ooh. I struggle because I love that one, but I also really love their red velvet.
Like, oh, the red velvet
it's so
too.
So cliche, but
oh yeah.
So I get the Buntinis, box of a dozen, because then I get to have a little bit of everything, and it feels like one serving when I have it with my tea in the morning. So I'm with you.
Like, yeah,
I don't want a whole big bundt cake. I want all of the little ones.
See, I do the little ones and the big one. But let's go to the next question. And that will be my last question. What is your favorite thing to do outside of work?
Oh my goodness. You are speaking my language. Outside of work, I'm all about food, flights, and a good fit. I love to travel. I'm trying to condition myself. I'm practicing to be carry-on only, but I have to have an agenda that includes great meals, mm-hmm. beautiful views, and at least one luxury I probably don't need because why not? We're on vacation. When I'm home, you'll find me in stylish glasses, huddled up with my Kindle, or turning over our guest room to host friends visiting from out of town. So we live in Ohio. We're from New York. Originally, most of our friends and family are there, and we've met a lot of friends over the years being transplants. So hospitality is my love language. A little dash of whimsy and a well-stocked welcome basket, that just makes my day. Just makes my day.
Oh, you sound like a fabulous hostess. Yes, I do plan my trip around food and some activities. So I actually, before I travel, I already know where I will have breakfast, lunch, dinner. Like I'm the admin, like at work, you're kind of the boss, but at home, I'm like the secretary making things happen. But I love it.
That you're the chief operating officer. You're the vacation curator.
Nice. I love it. I love how you're empowering me right now.
Vacation curator, because I'm not going and not having a good time. And we are not leaving it to chance. And I'm reading every Google review before I go. Because I can't be disappointed.
Yeah.
Like, I only get one shot. So you got to nail it. I love vacation curator.
Yes, vacation curator. I'm going to use it moving
forward. You're not the admin. You're not the secretary. Vacation experience extraordinaire.
Ooh, man. I need to have like a summer right here. And then I'll just like summer rub like a genie. Give me good words. Thank you.
I'm just a text away, always.
Thank you. Thank you so much for being on the show. It was so great having you.
This was the absolute highlight of my day. I feel like I can put a check mark through one of my goals, which was to sit down with you. We haven't even unpacked just how amazing you are.
Thank you.
And you've given me a lot of inspiration around doing it, adding 10,000 more letters behind my name so I can catch up with you because you have quite a few. And really stepping through the process and being a possibility model. If nothing else, what I loved most about stumbling onto you, you represent the art of possible. And I think there aren't a lot of podcasts like yours. And it just is so refreshing to know that you're here, you're building, you're growing. You mentioned that you're in season 2, and anybody I can send your way to make sure that you make it to season 20, I'm happy to do it because this is just fantastic work. So the pleasure was all mine.
And that's it for today's episode of The Diary of a CFO. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to like, review, subscribe, and share with others. Our website is thediaryofacfo.com. That's where you can find all the episodes, access all the guest profiles, see their bios and the social media links. It is also the place where you can apply to be a guest on the podcast and have information about how you can sponsor the show. As always, if there is any topic you would like me to cover in the future, just email me at ask@thediaryofacfo.com. Again, the email is ask@thediaryofacfo.com. See you soon.